Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that registrations will be opening very soon for my next 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools you need to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you're interested in finding out more, you can DM me the word ready, or alternatively, you can contact me through my website and we'll set up a time to connect. It's important I let you know that these groups run at limited numbers. Now, I do this intentionally so that it's an intimate space for you to do the deep inner work. But because of this, spots are limited and the April intake is already filling up. I can't wait to see you inside the container for a life-transforming experience. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today's guest is registered dietitian nutritionist, Dr. David Wiss. David works as a nutrition counselor who specializes in treating eating disorders as well as substance abuse. Having his own dark past with drugs, which eventually led to him being incarcerated in 2006, David offers a unique blend of lived experience combined with a PhD in public health and health psychology. David is a thought leader in the space of nutrition and the direct correlation it has to mental health, which is what inspired him to launch Wise Mind Nutrition, an app that delivers educational content using nutrition and lifestyle medicine to improve mental health outcomes. So dialing in from West Los Angeles, I'd love to welcome Dr. David Wiss onto the show. David, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you today?
Life is good. I'm so thrilled to be here. I love the theme of the podcast. I love your energy and I can't wait to build some momentum with you.
Absolutely. I'm super excited. As I was researching yourself and preparing for this episode, I just got more and more excited because I think you have such an incredible background, which combined with the work you're doing today really does put you in that unique position. And I think our audience is going to get a lot from this conversation today. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Now, before we dive into your photo, I want to start with some nice questions to allow our audience just to get to know you a little bit better. So can we start off with, where did you grow up? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
Excellent. So I am from West Los Angeles. And if anyone is familiar with the Los Angeles area, it's close to where the 10 and the 405 meet, right here on the west side. And believe it or not, I actually live currently on the same street that I grew up on. So I ended up, I ended up buying a home four blocks from where I grew up. You know, I'm close to where I started and to where my father is. And so I am truly in my own center of the universe. And of course, I've bounced around over the years and been in different parts of Los Angeles. But yes, I am here near Century City. I do have a counseling and consulting practice where I work individually with people. And I've been doing that for 11 years. And so I've seen over thousands of people. I've put in the 10,000 hours of doing this one-on-one work. And there has actually been a few times in my life when I had an office walking distance from where I live. So if you know anything about LA, one of the major shortcomings is the traffic. So we sometimes brag about how little driving we do. And so I've had that going on. I've been in the same office now for 6 years, and I'm actually in the process of moving to a new one that is walking distance from where I live. So Those are part of my goals, to spend part of the time in the office doing counseling. And then, of course, I have a home office and I'm involved in some academic stuff still. I do mental health science, so I've written quite a few papers and I actually collect data in my private practice. And in December, I coded it all up and I ran some models. And so I've been working on a few papers there. And then, of course, in the last year or so, I got involved in tech in a very real way and built an app. So let's just say I'm never bored. I always have work to do. There's always something to read, something to write, a webinar to watch, or a podcast to listen to. So yes, I am a hungry soul and I love being able to do a couple of different things. I think there are people that do clinical work that wish they were in research, and there's people that are in research that wish they were in clinical work, and I get to do both and do some tech stuff as well. So I feel very, very fortunate.
That sounds like your cup is full. In fact, it sounds like it's overflowing. Tell me, what do you do for fun?
So fun is definitely something that has evolved over time. I think I grew up, like a lot of people, looking for what I like to call organized fun, things to do that are fun. And I have found that at age 42, and I have a 21-month-old daughter, and we are pregnant with another one on the way.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, that I have the most fun in moments when I don't plan it and try to create it, right? So if that could be just hanging out with my wife and child and ending up in a joyful moment, I can have more fun if I'm not like going on a trip to have fun, if you know what I mean.
I guess it takes the pressure off, right? Like when you've got a weekend away or something, there's just all of this built up energy that, and these expectations, which we know with expectations are so very rarely ever met, right? I think I love that idea that disorganized fun is a lot better.
We do occasionally, and we haven't done it for a while, is me and my wife just get an Airbnb, like in the area, not even far, not even going on a plane, because, you know, we'll leave our daughter with grandma and just get a chance to unplug and unpack a little bit. That's super, super important for us.
I love that. We call that a staycation here in Australia. The same? Yeah.
Yep.
I love a staycation. Mm-hmm. That's so awesome. Thank you, David. That's great. I feel like we know you a little bit better now. Now, David, the format of the show, as you know, is that we ask guests to bring in a photo from a time in their life where they were hiding behind a smile. So this was a time where they were presenting one version of themselves to the outside world. But the reality was, internally, they were struggling. Now, you've sent across your photo, and it's quite the photo. I would love for you to please describe this photo for the audience who are listening here today. For those watching, you'll see the photo appearing now. Please describe the photo and also what was actually happening for you at that particular time in your life.
Yes. So the photo was from my early 20s, and this was a time when I was positive that I had stepped into my adulthood because I had found my independence from, you know, my family and from society. And I was part of counterculture, which in my case is underground music culture, rap music, rave music. That was a big part of my upbringing. And super into drugs, super into my outside appearance. And so I think that picture has a level of fashion to it that is fun to explore, because nowadays, like, I'm so not into mixing and matching and making everything look perfect. But at that time, in that photo, you could see that I am matching the different blues with the wallet chain and the hat. And I probably have a cufflink somewhere on my cargo pant pocket that matches. There's probably some shoelaces that match one of those cues of blue. Perhaps there was even a sock somewhere that matched. And I was really into having a particular look, and I wanted that look to be mysterious, but also track with a particular type of culture that I think was a really good distraction. I realized after I got into a new chapter with my life is that when I'm spending so much of my energy on my outside appearance, it's because there's something off in my internal world, and I'm trying to hide behind a stage character, right? And so I actually presented quite well with the stage character. I came across as someone who would be potentially even dangerous or violent. And I'm none of those things, right? But it seemed important at that time in the circles that I was in to be able to give off that impression. It was a survival mechanism for sure.
Yeah. So if in your internal world, you didn't really identify with that, what was driving you? Was it a desire to be accepted? Like you mentioned those circles that you were moving in, like what was drawing you that way?
I don't want to admit to being highly susceptible to influences of media, movies, music. I'd like to think that I am a very firm soul that is rooted, right? But I would be lying if I said that growing up, right, as a teenager, we listen to things, we watch movies, and we do emulate. And I definitely wouldn't have been able to admit this at the time. But there were personas that I was able to identify through hip hop culture that really resonated with me. And I think that I was able to step into that to, you know, be involved in all the different things that I was involved in, which did include music and counterculture, late night culture, party culture. And there was a lot of fast money to be made. So it was super exciting.
And so who was the David underneath all of that? Who was the real David inside?
Well, I am still in the process of figuring that out. The real me has shown up. And I think it's safe to say that there were some parts of that stage character that are very much the real me. In other words, I do believe myself to be a revolutionary in some ways. You know, in my field, many people look at me as a renegade. I'm always someone who pushes back on, you know, the mainstream discourse. I don't easily buy into narratives that are popular. I challenge the status quo. And so I do have, my mother was a hippie, right? So I do have inside of my soul at the core level, someone who doesn't easily opt in to the way things are, right? And so in that picture, I definitely have the embodiment of someone that is decided to not go the traditional route in life, right? But I think if I were to answer the question more specifically about, like, you know, who am I truly? In addition to that, I am a warm soul. I am someone who cares deeply about causes, and I have a deep concern for the welfare of other people. And, you know, I think that when there's fear, I was taught to never show it, you know, and to really, you know, minimize weakness and to look tough. And I think that there's parts of me that are tough, but I really just want a hug from my mommy. You know what I mean?
Can we go there now? Let's just take it back a little moment. So you've mentioned your mom a couple of times. I'd love to know a little bit more, David, about your environment growing up, what you were exposed to, and were there any significant memories that landed or perhaps shaped your formation into adulthood? Like you just mentioned then that you had this idea that, you know, fear is not to be shown. Tell me more about all of that.
Yes. So my mother and my father are very different embodiments, you know, and I think it's a classic masculine feminine model, right? My mother had a lot of the emotionality. My dad is, you know, pure logic, right? And I connected a lot with my mom. I'm the youngest of two sons. And I always kind of felt like I was my mommy's favorite, which was, you know, very special. My dad is a scientist. He's a retired orthopedic surgeon, and he did a lot of great academic work. But growing up, you know, I was told, like, if your dad's a doctor, like, you know, there was sort of this assumption that you had money. But my dad worked at the county hospital. He worked at like a publicly funded hospital where people got surgeries without having insurance. You get what I'm saying?
I'm with you.
It was more of a growing up with my dad getting paged during my baseball game when I really wanted him to be there because he had to go do a surgery on someone, right? My dad being gone on holidays doing emergency surgeries on people. So there was definitely a longing for some more of him growing up. But I remember a turning point, as you asked. I remember when I was like going to turn 16, I was expecting, you know, because I'm from West LA, I'm a socially advantaged person. My dad is a doctor. I was expecting him to like buy me a cool car. You know what I mean? And he just wasn't having it. He wasn't having it. I didn't get raised that way. You know what I mean? And it was very much like, no, you can get like an old bucket. And, you know, in my mind, I was already interested in this, you know, hip hop movement that's very appearance focused. All I wanted was a cool car, you know, growing up. And I remember thinking, if he's not going to support me in getting that, I'm going to have to get it on my own. And that's when I really started hustling, started trying to make my own money so that I could, you know, get a cool car that had rims on it with a big stereo inside of it. Like, these were the things that mattered growing up. What did you wear? What was your outfit? And what did you drive, right? Very surface level, shallow sort of interests, despite having some depth inside of me.
And how does a kid in West LA start hustling? What does that look like?
It was cannabis, you know, that was the game. And this was the 90s, okay? And Dr. Dre had his album, The Chronic, in 1992. And that was just like the cultural movement of the 90s. And, you know, it's now legal. But I grew up in a time when we were all hustling to smoke weed. And there was people that knew how to maneuver and make moves. And there was a lot of us that learned how to make money in that space.
And was that your introduction into actually using drugs, like around that same time? Was you know, cannabis, as they say, the gateway for you?
Yeah, it all started very young, you know, 12, 13, 14. You know, and then there was the psychedelics, moving into the rave culture with the MDMA and then the stimulants. And then, you know, it progressed very rapidly. And I'm actually making more sense out of that photo. I talked about a stage character needing to come across as violent or threatening. And hopefully it makes sense now. I was doing some illegal transactions, which necessitated a certain type of look.
Yeah, of course, right? Of course. And so with your own using and experimentation with drugs, I know that in some of the work you've read, you know, you were there using when that first wave of the opioid epidemic came through. What was that like? How did you navigate that?
That was such a wild time. It was mind-blowing how much access there was in my social circles to this new drug, which was OxyContin, right? There was, you know, Vicodins on the marketplace, and the progression is very predictable. You think about, like, you learn how to pop a Vicodin with your friends, and then you take one with a beer, and then you take two, and then you learn how to chew them up and take three, and then you move on to stronger versions of the drug and the morphine, Dilaudids. And, you know, I was using drugs at a time when the OxyContin 80s started to flood the streets. And I remember there were people that had them by the hundreds. It wasn't like they had a bottle that they got from someone's prescription. It felt like that there was a truck that went off of the freeway. You know what I'm saying? That exited. It felt like the supply of this stuff was unprecedented, right? I could get fentanyl lollipops and these really strong, strong life-threatening narcotics at like wholesale. You know what I mean? It was a wild time, and I definitely lost a few friends.
Yeah, that I was just about to ask that. You know, I've only ever seen, you know, from documentaries, and we're so far removed here in Australia from what went on there in America. But I imagine you did lose a lot of people at that time. And how did you not lose your life?
I think there was this sort of assumption, which has changed in recent years with the fentanyl crises, that you only die if you do IV. Right? That if you do pills or crush them up and snort them, or if you smoke things, that you'll be all right. And it's the people that step into intravenous drug use that die. And so I was able to avoid ever going that route. And I got close, like toward the end, when I think about my story, I had a few friends that were doing that. And I remember, like, I don't want to see, I don't want to know. I feel very fortunate to have been rescued from that life before like going down that road. And I'm pretty sure that I would have, even though I was super turned off by it. All it takes is like one really sick moment and having no other options. And
exactly right. Being in the grips of withdrawal, that being the only option. And then you just go, you know, you need the pain to stop. Like, you're dope sick. It's like, I'm just going to do what I need to do. It's, yeah, like you said, very easy to end up there, even if you don't logically ever want to go there.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So help me piece together then, David. You're a young kid, you've gotten caught up in dealing drugs, you're using drugs at the same time, and then you end up incarcerated in 2006 and put in Supermax, right? What was that experience like?
It was very fascinating how adaptable I was. I remember the beginning of it and being like, this is going to be very, very hard, and this is going to feel like forever. And then I remember the last few days coming up to, you know, getting released to a program. I got released to a rehab in my neighborhood back where I used to run around. I remember thinking when I was like toward the end, like, I could stay.
Wow.
Yeah. Like I had no problem doing it. Like, if I had to, like, I was adjusted. I had acclimated. It didn't, and of course I wanted out. I wanted a Marlboro red cigarette, and I wanted a, you know, a meal, and I wanted to be seen. Of course, all of those things were factors, but I remember feeling like I had acclimated to that way of life and that I could do whatever was necessary to survive.
I suppose it was that conditioning, right? That survival instinct that you'd been fine-tuning from such a young age. And perhaps being able to step into those different characters actually really helped you in that situation.
That's right. Very well said. I think I navigated it pretty well for the most part.
So tell me, how did you go about rebuilding your life when you came out of prison? Because I know that in the US there's particularly high recidivism rates, and then there's also the stigma that goes with that and trying to get a job. And, you know, you've gone on and gotten a PhD. Like, help me understand, because they're just such, those worlds are so far apart, and yet you've managed to forge this path for yourself.
It is statistically unlikely. Yeah, that is for sure. I do believe that when I started my life over, I was 24, I had a deep, deep hunger for something different. I wasn't sure what it was going to look like. I just knew that I didn't want to like live in an institutional setting. That was very, very obvious to me. I still had the mentality of, I want to be connected to the cultures, you know, and I wanted to still dress the same way and listen to the same music and be around the same people. Some of that got pretty old pretty quickly. One of the biggest turning points I had was that I just one day, when I entered this treatment facility in Culver City, like I said, in my own little backyard, I stopped telling all the stories that I had been telling for so long about the people that I knew and the cars that I drove. And that was a huge turning point because I saw how deeply attached to my past I was in an almost glorifying way. Right? Like, I had survived some of the wildest stuff, and people knew me as this, and I wasn't in the best place in my life because I had all my stuff in a storage unit. I'm now in a lot of debt. I've got a couple felony convictions. And so naturally, one would try to like recapture the spirit of yesteryear, right? And like try to live and like, do you remember me? I remember calling people from the payphone. That's how long ago it was, from the payphone. And just trying to like get people on the phone that remembered who I was when I had it all looking cool on the outside, right? And it started to feel dark.
I think as well, though, it's that whole idea of like what's familiar. And so coming out of prison, it would be so natural for you to go back to an environment that felt familiar rather than trying to forge a path that is so unknown.
That's right.
How long were you in this program for, this treatment program?
I lived there for 6 months, which was very cool. It was actually like part of my commitment to the courts, right? That I would complete this program afterwards. And so it really sort of helped me. I transitioned directly there. You know, it was a faith-based rehab that was focused on Judaism, which was super important for me growing up. And it was part of, you know, who I am, and was able to access some of that spiritual energy early on through song. And I remember like playing the piano and like being in the choir and just starting to feel spirit again, right? I was in a large community of other people people that had been through, you know, the system, all walks of life. I'll be honest, you know, I didn't know where it was headed, but I knew that I wanted things to be different. They had a gym there and they had a salad bar. And those were just like two things that I had never really played around with. And I really did one day kind of feel like my life was at a really clear turning point, that I could stay trapped in the mentality or I could get into health. And I didn't have a nutritionist. I didn't have a trainer. I didn't have someone tell me that this is what I should do. Intuitively, I knew that I should start trying to lift things that were heavy and try to eat foods that I had never ate before. It really was just that simple. Just do the opposite of what I had been doing before, you know? And I started to make these colorful plates and just like have lots of fiber and started drinking a ton of water. And I started going up on the roof and like getting sunlight. And I think my motivation was probably vanity focused at first, right? I wanted to like feel better, look better. But what happened for me changed the trajectory of my life. I had a rapid transformation in my mental health and my whole aura changed. My skin changed, you know, my relational health changed. People started commenting that like, you're so different. Cause I came there pale, you know what I'm saying? And I had been eating a lot of ultra processed foods. And I was unwell, and I had a chance to really explore wellness. And I believe that a lot of people want to get into exercise, nutrition, wellness, and are hoping that they would have the kind of experience that I had, which was like this huge revolution. You know what I mean? Like within a few months, I was a different person. You know, my eyes were glowing, right? Everyone was like, you gotta keep doing this, or can you help me? That's how it started. People were like, can you help me? What are you doing? And I was like, sure. And I started helping people. And so it almost felt like the universe pulled me into wellness, right? Into nutrition, because they were asking for help. And I said, I want to help you, but I also want to make sure I don't harm you. So what do I got to do? I'm going to go back to school and figure this out.
Oh my God, that's such an amazing story. Thank you for sharing, David. What I love about that story, and I find this is such a similar thread through the lives of those of us that choose to get clean and sober, is that when we're in the throes of addiction, it really blocks us off from spirit, like you were describing. But then when we remove the drugs, when we remove the alcohol, whatever it is that you're using to disconnect from the world, all of a sudden, the road that you were meant to walk is revealed. And so often, like with my own experience, I didn't even have to do anything. All I had to do was get out of my own way, stop taking drugs and alcohol, get out of my own way, and just start to lean in and trust and connect to that intuition. And then all of a sudden, you're guided to the exact place you're meant to be. And you know, I describe it as, you know, finding your purpose. And it sounds like that's exactly what's happened in your life, David, which is incredible. So tell me, you go back, you study, which is phenomenal. You get yourself a PhD. What inspired you to create Nutrition in Recovery?
So that actually happened before the PhD. I got a master's pretty quickly after I had gotten sober. And it was even difficult for me to get into a California state school because I don't look that great on paper, if you know what I mean. Like I had periods of absenteeism in my undergrad. My grades weren't great. You know, but it took a lot of effort for me to get into a very like modest or easy to get into program to become a registered dietitian. And this was in my early years of recovery. And I was super clear on what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back to the rehab that I got sober in and teach a nutrition group, you know, and that's how Nutrition in Recovery started. And when I was finished school, I was a dietetic intern and I ran a group at the place that I started my life over. And I had a chance to teach all the other clients that were there about what we knew at the time about eating and eating disorders and food addiction. And this was right around the time gut health started to become popularized. And I created a curriculum. And then I launched my company, Nutrition in Recovery, which is a private practice that I have worked with people over the years. And then I had other sober people that were like, can I be your intern? And I was like, yes. And, you know, was able to train them to use my curriculum to run groups. And then we just started getting dietitians that had a very niche specialty in recovery. And I've always said, like, yeah, nutrition and recovery, like we're here to educate about nutrition, but for some of us, the real passion is recovery. And that's the reason why the groups go so well. It's not because like we have some, you know, some information that other people don't have. It's the energy of recovery, the rooting for the underdog, right? And that energy that we bring into the group. So nutrition and recovery was a huge success. And I was able to write some things. I think I started with a newsletter, and then I got, someone asked me to be a part of a professional newsletter. Then I got asked to be a part of a book chapter. And then from there, I was like, I wanted to write more. And I wanted to write one of these peer-reviewed papers. And I remember like poking around and asking someone like, can I write with you? And I wrote a paper, a manuscript while I was working at a treatment center, and about treatment, about what we were doing with eating disorders. And so from there, that all snowballed into, I love research. I love academia. I want to go on and get a PhD. And I didn't get in the first time either, right? Like it took me work, because the stuff that I'm talking about, nutrition for mental health, it's still considered a little fringy. I mean, it's funny, you're in Australia. A lot of the research comes from Australia, right? UK, Canada. I don't know that it's implemented just like, you know, here in the US, but a lot of the thought leaders are in Australia. I wanted to do research on nutrition for substance use. I did my master's thesis on that, and I wanted to do my PhD on that, but it was just not going to happen. There wasn't enough support. There wasn't enough people that knew about it. So I had to switch gears, and I did my PhD dissertation on adverse childhood experiences and how early life trauma affects human health and mental health.
Which, oh my goodness, is a whole nother podcast and a whole nother conversation. That's fantastic and so fascinating as well. I'd love to know a little bit more about, what are you observing when you look at the connection between people who are in addiction, nutrition, and then their mental health? Like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg in all of this?
Yes. So I think my original obsession, I'll call it an obsession, was like trying to use nutrition to improve addiction outcomes. Like this idea, because it was so profound for me, right? It like increased my chances of staying sober. And I ended up getting this really rich and meaningful and full life from, you know, wellness and spirituality and other things as well. But I think what I've kind of come to realize over the years is that, you know, nutrition has a pretty profound, potentially pretty profound impact on depression and anxiety, which, you know, cluster and co-occur with addictions. So like if someone has trauma, anxiety, and a substance use disorder, you know, one can use nutrition to reduce anxiety and like not be subjected to the biological embedding of adversity, right? All the adverse effects of early life trauma wearing down on the nervous system and the immune system. But the other piece, and I think this is what you're more asking about, is the dopaminergic response that people get from foods, the reward-based eating or hedonic eating or addiction-like eating. I've been very interested in that as a potential cross addiction, or also as a risk factor for binge eating or a risk factor for restriction and other eating disorders. So I've sort of positioned myself as a go-to for people that have co-occurring eating disorder and substance use disorder, because they were traditionally looked at as these sort of separate things. And there's some opposite philosophy related to them, right? And it becomes this really tricky thing to navigate. The addiction world seems to be kind of abstinence-based in some ways, and the eating disorder world is more about inclusivity and moderation. And so I noticed that there were these different sort of camps out there in the world. And a lot of my career has been dedicated to thinking about, instead of either this or that, how do we talk about the convergence of these issues, the both and, rather than the either or, to think about these tricky intersectional gray areas where nuance is definitely needed.
I was reading in a paper that you wrote about the controversy that's surrounding food addiction, and you seem to have some really strong thoughts on this. And thank you for just explaining that conversion point of, you know, the way that we treat co-occurring or cross addictions so differently, which can be, I think, confusing for the patient. Can we, when we focus on this idea of food addiction for a little bit more time, can we talk about, firstly, I want to know how, because you touched on this earlier, you've spent a lot of time looking at adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma. I think there's a lot of, like, there's a louder conversation around how that can impact or influence falling into drugs or alcohol or some sort of, you know, maladaptive coping behavior there. But I haven't heard a lot of people talking about how this can directly link to food addiction or some sort of eating disorder. Can you talk a little bit more to that point, David?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, we could dive into the biological mechanisms, which I'm a fan of, understanding the pathways that link these associations. And then, of course, there's other perspectives there, you know, socioeconomic status or ascribed meaning or, you know, relational rupture. And there's just so many potential avenues to analyze. It's a biopsychosocial question, right? Like, trauma affects biology, psychology, social context, our entire environment. So it's a loaded question. But in the most simple form, the link between trauma and addiction is so strong, right? We know this from the early ACE studies that people that have multiple ACEs are 5, 6, 7, as much as 10 times more likely to use illicit drugs. Arguments have been made that people don't have addiction without some developmental trauma, right? That's part of, you know, the picture, which, you know, I don't always necessarily know to be true, but I think we all have some form of stress, trauma, and adversity. It's just what it gets coupled with and the brain associates it with, right? That can certainly cement an addiction. But a lot of the research on ultra-processed food addiction, and I'm calling it ultra-processed food addiction versus food addiction because we've identified the specific types of food that are addicting. People push back a lot on food addiction because they say, well, an apple or an almond is not addicting. But, like, you know, our data suggests that these ultra-processed foods, cookies, cakes, chips, sodas, et cetera, are the foods that elicit the dopamine response. So a lot of the research early on was just on how all substance use disorders share neurobiological overlap, right? Which is, you know, the continued use despite negative consequences because of the increased salience, the increased value that one assigns to the substance, almost equating it to survival, right? And so if someone has a long history of trauma and they've used substances that make negative affect go away, their brain will be tricked into thinking that it's a survival promoting behavior, even though it's not, right? And if you were to just transfer the neurobiology of substance use disorder and addiction and look at other addictions, right? Caffeine, nicotine, sugar, ultra processed foods, you know, gambling, behavioral addiction, sex, porn, the overlap neurobiologically is super clear, right? So it just makes total sense from that premise that trauma is actually a risk factor for all forms of substance seeking behavior, reward-based behavior, with food just being one of them, but food being a super important one because it's so easily accessible and it's so socially acceptable, right?
And I also feel like for young adolescents, even children who perhaps don't have access to drugs and alcohol yet, food is something that they can control, whether that is binging or restricting.
And it's something that they can learn to, like you said, manipulate, you know, use as almost like a self-medication, right? And so, yes, we have data to suggest that, you know, ACEs increase eating behavior, increase BMI, right? And I believe that this increase in food addiction symptoms is actually a major driver of eating disorder incidence and prevalence. That, you know, one of the reasons why people become very restrictive, possibly move into anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, is because the food is more rewarding than it should be because of the early life trauma.
And the impact it's having on the brain. Wow. And then you also talk about weight stigma and diet culture being a tool of oppression. Tell me about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I've always talked about nutrition being a tool of oppression, giving people low quality food, especially in, you know, corrections and in rehabs, publicly funded food service operations. Nutrition is a tool of oppression. But of course, there's other psychosocial factors which keep people feeling less than, feeling marginalized. And when people feel less than and feel marginalized, they're more likely to spend money on products, right? So when you can create insecurities in people, it's a known formula for commercial enterprise. And so I think a lot of people have determined that diet culture, you know, is preying on vulnerable people. Diet culture is an assumption that, you know, being super invested in your appearance and eating less than you should is normal behavior, right? And so it's gotten normalized that people would be against the body that they live in, wishing they were someone else, somewhere else, right? In a different version of themselves, and to engage in behaviors that supposedly support that. But our data suggests that sometimes people's efforts to diet, and when they internalize this weight stigma that exists in society, it doesn't actually improve their health. It makes it worse.
And so is the antithesis of that the body positivity movement, or is that also just as toxic?
Such a good question. The body positive movement is a very important movement which helps people drop out of diet culture. And it has the potential to free people from the traps, the cognitive traps of being, you know, waging war with themselves. But the fat positive, body positive movement, which is super critical to eating disorder treatment and recovery, I believe has become a little bit toxic because it's gotten very much pitted against, you know, the other extreme, which is diet culture. But then they're like also against wellness culture, right? If there's someone that wants to be interested in their health, they call it dieting. The real toxicity, in my opinion, comes from the big food corporations that amplify that message. They find really well-intentioned dietitians that are doing really important eating disorder work and prevention work, and then, you know, try to amplify this message, which is like, don't worry about the food supply, just eat it intuitively, you'll be fine, right? And it's a great message, but you get what I'm saying? They amplify it for the whole population so that it feels like anyone who's interested in health has an eating disorder or they're orthorexic, right? And so people are afraid to like be interested in health now, right? Because you don't want to be perceived as disordered by your peers and colleagues. And that's the era that we're in, which is what I think has created a lot of uncertainty, inauthenticity, and toxicity.
And everyone's just so afraid of being canceled that no one's saying anything.
That's right. That's right. I'm saying something. I'm trying
to. Good. I love that. You keep talking, keep shouting it from the rooftops.
You got it.
And David, you've mentioned a couple of times this idea of cross addiction. I'd love you to touch on this a little bit more for our audience who perhaps don't know what cross addiction is. And within that, can you talk about the prevalence and what you're seeing out there, particularly when people may get a handle on their substance use or their eating disorder? Like, what happens after that?
Yeah, I think the most predictable trajectory with substance use disorder is caffeine and nicotine. You know, these are highly socially acceptable drugs in the recovery circle. Even the original writings of recovery from 1939, right? They have it in there, right? They smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. Of course, now it's more like an energy drink and a vape, right? We've evolved in some ways. But those are very socially acceptable stimulants for early recovery. And then, of course, refined sugar and ultra processed foods. And I think if someone has been on something like crystal meth or opioids or cocaine, hard drugs for many, many years, if you put them in a, you know, residential treatment and you give them unlimited access to like caffeine, nicotine, and highly palatable food, like it's manageable. You know what I'm saying? Like it's manageable.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, David. The rehab that I went to, when I went in, I was a smoker. I'd been smoking for about 15 years and you weren't allowed. It was a rehab that was no sugar, no caffeine, no nicotine. And so we just went in cold turkey. And they supported you to detox, medically supported you to detox. So it was done in a safe environment. But then it was pretty much like, you're going to feel your feelings and you don't have anything to distract. And look, I was really grateful for that because for me personally, I'd tried to stop smoking for probably a decade and I never could. And then that was the thing that, you know, that worked for me. And I gave up cigarettes at that point. But then a lot of my friends and the community have gone to a rehab that's here in Melbourne where you're allowed to drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and eat sugar. And it's really interesting just to see the difference because I do then find that people that come out of that rehab are then really reliant on their vape or their coffee or whatever it is. So I don't know. Like, I don't know what the better option is. I guess it's different for everyone.
It's the conundrum of being a healthcare provider. When I think about that, you know, from a business perspective, right? I'm pretty sure that the no caffeine, no nicotine, no sugar would create better outcomes. But it almost seems like that other rehab is a better business model because you're just going to, like, people are going to be like, I can go there. Right. And so there's this trade-off in the healthcare world of like, is it, you know, is it about like filling the beds? Because I've actually seen places in LA that want to take that point of view of like, let's have a really strong point of view about food and, you know, nicotine, caffeine. But there's so many treatment centers that like, we got to get people in here. You know what I mean? And if that means giving them their cigarettes, then they'll end up doing it, right? So this tricky trade-off, yeah, I could see that being a real head scratcher for some people.
That's so true. I'd never thought of it like that. You make such a good point. So David, if somebody's listening here today, perhaps they're in the early stages of their recovery journey and they know that nutrition is going to help them feel better, but they don't know where to start. What's some advice that you could give to them?
Yeah, my framework from the Wise Mind Nutrition program, the app, I have a couple different components, I call them. The first is starting with when to eat. And this is just a way to think about structuring some consistency with food. I think erratic food patterns where like one day you eat breakfast, the next day you don't, you know, you go 8 hours without eating, right? And it's just completely erratic. I think that sends a signal of unsafety to the body that makes it difficult to get into rest and digest, right? So really good places to start this comes from me doing this one-on-one work with people for many years. Start with thinking about your beverages, right? Just change your beverages, right? And I don't want to make any sweeping claims about what that should look like, but let's just say water is your friend, okay? If you can move toward drinking mostly water, right? And possibly reduce some of the caffeinated, sweetened, and artificially sweetened beverages, and just drink like 2 to 3 liters of water every day. And then you figure out what's a realistic bedtime, wake time, and sort of eating schedule. And I think that before people even think about changing what they eat, you could just do that for 2 weeks. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's not even get into the nitty-gritty of the food group system and whole grains versus refined grains and the types of fats. Just change your beverages and get into a pattern. You know, start there. Yeah. And then from there, right, you can start to think about what to eat. And this is when I would introduce a food group system and say, you know, we've got fruits, vegetables, whole grains, dairy or alternative dairies, proteins or protein alternatives, and then beans, nuts, seeds, and then fats from avocados, coconuts, olives. And like, let's just get all of that in every single day. You know, let's start there, right? And from there, it's like, okay, now like, let's try to get all of those things in twice a day. And then pretty soon you're starting to see like what food groups you're eating more of, which ones you're getting less of. And you can use a very simple food group system to dial in what to eat. And I like a food group system because it's flexible. You could go anywhere on the earth and try to make sure you get 3 different food groups at a meal, right? It's not like, oh, this is my lunch. It's like you have principles. For example, someone could say, I'm going to try to eat 4 or 5 times a day. Whenever I eat, I'm going to try to get 3 food groups at all the meals and snacks, right? That's a really simple, flexible approach, right? And I'm going to try to eat real food. From there, after someone has focused on beverages, when to eat, what to eat, I like to move people into how to eat. That is how we are as an eater, mindful eating, how we connect to food, the rate at which we consume food, the rate at which we chew food, right? Are we standing? Are we sitting, right? What's going on at the table? Is it cluttery? You know, are we watching TV or scrolling on TikTok, right? Like, so there's a lot in the mindful, soulful eating that involves grocery shopping, cooking, there's a lot there that one could build on. And I believe if you have a plan of when to eat, what to eat, and how to eat, the how much to eat question just sort of answers itself, right? Like, you'll know, you'll be able to trust your body. A lot of people come to someone like me and they're like, I just want you to tell me how much to eat. You know, is it 2/3 of a cup or 3/4 of a cup? I'm like, I don't know. How would I know? I have no idea, right? Like, what else is in your meal? What else is in your day? Were you active? Like, that very math-centric approach to nutrition is what I've been really pushing back on. I got into calories and macros when I got into like school and started like learning about my protein and all of that. But that's a very basic introductory way of looking at nutrition. I'm here to encourage people to go beyond the quantities and start learning about the qualities of foods, eating foods with lots of different colors, thinking about the degrees of processing, whether it's organic versus conventional. There's just a lot of things to think about other than calories and macros that most people miss when you're using MyFitnessPal or that type of an app.
And I love what you said just then about becoming an intuitive eater, because for somebody who's spent years in addiction, for me personally, one of the biggest things that has come out of my own recovery journey is my connection back to my intuition. Like, when people used to say to me, trust your gut, I was like, how do you do that? It was unfathomable to me. And now I am completely led by my gut every single day. And that does play into the way that I can listen to my body and then have a relationship with food, because I also was somebody who had a really unhealthy relationship with food from a young age. And it's now, I'm just over 4 years sober. It's only now that I'm actually starting to get a handle on this. But I also love what you said, David, about keep it simple in the beginning. Start by just focusing on your beverages. And the other thing that came to mind when you were sharing just then was that often when I speak to people who are in early recovery, they find that they've got all of this time on their hands. And like, one of the things they say is, you know, how am I going to fill my time? This is how you can fill your time. Become obsessed with this stuff. This is all stuff that is going to put you in such good stead for the long run. Like, you're investing back in yourself, and it's a healthy obsession versus a detrimental one.
It reminds me of my early recovery, just walking the aisles of the grocery store, just like being super curious and flipping things over and be like, what's this? And giving it a try and really nourishing myself back to mental health.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. On that note, David, I'd love to ask you one final question. The question is, what do you do in your life every day? I want to know what your three non-negotiables are that allow you to live happy, joyous, and free.
Great question. The first one that comes to mind is, I have a vulnerable answer for you, okay? And I'm going to be honest. For me, to live my best life, I have to be off of caffeine, for me. And a lot of people, and at 4 years sober, or even at 7 years sober, that would not have been the case, right? I have 17 years of caffeine abuse to the point now where, like, if I use it, it is very predictable that I'll use it again the next day and be anxious within a few days, and I will be anxious again. So I do have anxiety, and for me to manage that, it requires me to be off caffeine, which means that I go to sleep at a reasonable hour. I have some workaholic tendencies. You've probably figured out I worked full time during a PhD program and then launched an app right afterwards. Okay. Like, you might assume that I go a little bit hard. Okay. And that means there's been a lot of late nights. There's been a lot of those sort of go, go, go tendencies. And for me now, where I'm at in my life is like off the caffeine, go to sleep early, no hurries, no worries, make sure that I do yoga and some other form of contemplative practices. Otherwise, I can be a very unwell person. I will admit that. I can.
Oh, thank you. That's I'm so glad you shared that. I'm in a love-hate relationship with caffeine at the moment. I went to a health retreat the end of 2022, and I then came off it for 6 months, and then it crept back in, and I'm at a phase right now where I'm not willing to let it go, but I do hope that I get to that point, because I know that, you know, the less I can put into my body that's going to alter my state of being, like, that's the place that I want to live from. So I really appreciate your honesty there. David, I've loved our conversation today, and I know that our audience will as well. If they want to track you down, find out more, get a hold of the app, where can they go?
Yes, my clinical practice website is called nutritioninrecovery.com. The app is called Wise Mind Nutrition, and that's wisemindnutrition.com. There are social media on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube for Wise Mind Nutrition. My personal Instagram is Dr. David Wiss, and I love to hear from people. I love to hear from people that are using the app. If someone's using the app, you can send a message and I personally will get back to you and make sure that you feel supported in the app. There's a lot of features in there where you can share data and connect with people so that you're not doing it alone. And I've always sort of made myself available to support anyone, follow you, offer you encouragement, feedback, etc.
That's amazing. I'll make sure I pop all of that information in the episode show notes. David, we say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so, so much for being here today. I appreciate you.
You're so welcome.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.